Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, protests become calmer for the most part and lead to policy changes and a new art installation on the pavement on South Tryon Street. The Republican National Convention moves its big night to Jacksonville, Florida, where that stands, we'll tell you, as COVID-19 cases continue to rise here in Charlotte and in Jacksonville. NASCAR bans Confederate flags at all of their events, and former Panthers owner Jerry Richardson's statue comes down. For how long is the question? Here to update us on all of that and a lot more this morning, Steve Harrison is with us, political reporter for WFAE News. Good morning, welcome.
Morning, Mike.
Katie Peralta is here. She's the senior editor for Charlotte Agenda. Morning, Katie.
Morning.
Nick Oxner is WBTV's investigative executive producer. Thank you for joining us.
Hello.
And Jonathan Lowe is reporter anchor for Spectrum News. Good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning, Mike.
The protests over the death of George Floyd are in their third week now, and they continue, even though he's been laid to rest. But this week, something changed. The tensions surrounding most of the protests around the country have calmed down for the most part, though on Wednesday night, I think five people were arrested on I-277 after they blocked traffic as part of a protest. Why did this happen? I thought we were beyond this. What happened exactly? Anybody?
I mean, the protests are ongoing, even though they have diminished quite substantially in size. There have been protesters arrested throughout the course of these last 2 weeks of protests now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even if it is a small number of people, blocking a roadway is something that they cannot do. So,
yeah. And Mike, to put some more context, sorry, I couldn't unmute myself fast enough after you first asked the question of life in the age of Zoom. Is this the rest followed late in the evening the other night after an early evening and afternoon of peaceful protests? This was about 20 protesters who made their way onto 277. And not only did they get on the interstate, but they blocked the interstate with traffic barrels so right. that cars couldn't move. And so police said this was quite a disturbance. They arrested these folks. It took some time to get the road back open. Interestingly, though, Mike, about a week or maybe a little more than a week ago, police had previously been using tear gas and rubber bullets to keep protesters off of major roadways. And so we see if a group of 20 folks can get onto 277 and stop traffic, we've obviously seen a revision in the amount of officers that they're using. And
but they were able to clear this, I read somewhere, that in about 6 minutes, and I'm without tear gas and without pepper bullets. How did they do it so quickly?
I wasn't there, so I don't know. Okay. But you know, it's a good point though that we're seeing police have revised the strategies that they're mm-hmm. using right after the controversy of last week and the criticism from last week, and they're doing so and still keeping people safe.
So Wednesday was the same. That's the same night, I believe, this happened on I-277. It was the same night that the Million Youth March of Charlotte and Salisbury added another focus to these demonstrations, the homeless.
We see you. We love you. We see you. We love you. We see you. We love you.
So how did this figure into what has been a series of protests about inequities in our criminal justice system? How did the shift? How did the focus shift to the homeless? Or why? Nobody knows the answer. Okay, but how big was this contingent?
Still trying to unmute. Look, sorry. So the protester said, we're marching for social justice and for change. And so we're not going to leave out this needs to be about police reform and Black Lives Matter. But it also needs to be about drawing attention to these folks in our community who also need help. So this was a way of highlighting, a different part of social equity and thinking about that.
So we had about 50 people involved in that effort to hand out food and personal hygiene products to Charlotte's homeless. There were about 20 involved in the incident on 277, and about 100 people marched on Tryon where a Black Lives Matter mural was painted on Monday, which we'll talk about a little later. And then there were hundreds of people later on that evening at Romare Bearden Park in a vigil called Silence for the Silence, designed to honor those killed by police and organized by the Charlotte Youth Climate Collective. Were these all distinct groups, or are these people shifting back and forth to various different protests and various different groups holding protests?
I think, Mike, you just have, you know, you have various groups that have come together for, you know, they usually will come together for one large protest. But, you know, I don't think it's, you know, uncommon to have different groups with different focuses. I know you have, for instance, Million Youth March has been taking, you know, been playing a big role. That's the organization of mostly teenagers who have, you know, in the off time when we don't have a pandemic and racial inequality issues, they're usually working to end teen violence and keep teens in school. Yeah. Charlotte Uprising obviously has been involved. I know that there have been educators that have held their own protests on the weekends. So I don't think things have really stopped. I think what, in my purview, we've seen things transition to more peaceful protests aimed at, you know, specific issues of social injustice. And so that's why you're seeing various groups and these protests continue. And just earlier this week, was the third and final funeral for George Floyd down in Houston, Texas. So as we saw, you know, the memorial services play out for him starting last weekend, I think that many of the protests were trying to coincide with people saying their final goodbyes to George Floyd and trying to honor him as well.
And these protests have been going on for about 3 weeks now. I guess beginning tonight would be the third week or the beginning of the fourth week. And they are actually leading to the promise of change. I'm not sure they'll lead to change, but the promise of change has certainly picked up some steam. And here in Charlotte, City Councilman at Large Braxton Winston, who was arrested on the first night of the demonstrations here in Charlotte, took police to task on Monday night at the City Council meeting for using tactics that he compared to those of Birmingham, Alabama's Bull Connor. Many people don't know who that is, but he was the police chief in Birmingham during the civil rights movement that used German shepherds and fire hoses on civil rights protesters in the 1960s. Here's what Braxton had to say to CMPD.
If you cannot figure out how to deal with human beings without the tactics of violence and fear, the human beings that make up this city will be here step by step to show you how to deal with us as the sentient beings that we are.
Pretty emotional. Council then voted 9-2, all the Democrats voting in favor, the two Republicans voting no for Winston's motion to prohibit the police from buying tear gas in the next fiscal year, which begins July the 1st. We know what kind of impact that might have on police. Steve.
Yeah, so last year, this police spent about $100,000 on tear gas and pepper balls, things like that. They said they had no plans to buy any this year. So it's, on one sense, you can say, oh, it's this tiny sliver of their budget, right? But this vote, I assume, will come up again a year from now, and there will be another year-long prohibition on buying tear gas and pepper balls. So I think it's a pretty big deal in terms of, I'm not really sure how eventually the CMPD has a lot of tear gas on reserve. They'll buy a lot for the Republican National Convention. Eventually they will run out. I'm not sure whenever they'll have authorization to buy more.
Yeah, the $103,000, I guess we could, CMPD won't say how much. They wouldn't even tell the mayor, I don't think. The mayor wouldn't tell me on Wednesday how much they have in reserve. Maybe she doesn't know. But you could do the math. Somebody could find out how much a tear gas canister cost, and $103,000, you do the math, you'll figure it out.
Police,
right?
Told the council that they wouldn't tell the council how much they had. And I'm not sure if that was because the incoming police chief didn't know or didn't want to say.
And I think, too, I was going to say just one more thing, Mike. It was interesting. Braxton Winston's comments about Bull Connor in Birmingham, you know, he was kind of comparing CMPD's tactics to that. But that was what Chief Putney said as well. Like the chief's comments were, we are using gas because we don't want to use batons and shields. And so they were both kind of making this point about the early 1960s. I just thought that was interesting. that was Putney's basic, his biggest defense for keeping gas.
Yeah, and because Braxton's point is that tear gas isn't a less violent means to controlling a crowd or dispersing a crowd. It fills your lungs. It's hard to breathe. It blinds you for a second. It's really quite a violent use of chemical agents. And so I think his point is, when that happens to you, and to my knowledge, he's, I think, the only city council member who's been tear gassed multiple times, or at least more times than he can count. It's something that stays with you, and it's not a peaceful means to deal with a crowd. And his argument is it actually has an opposite effect, in that it does escalate tension with a crowd when that tear gas is dispersed.
Of course, Kerr Putney is saying that the use of batons, police batons, beating somebody with a baton or with a shield is brutal, and he doesn't want to do that if he can help it. So this motion came as a result, obviously, of the previous Tuesday night, in which CMPD essentially corralled people into a one-block area, I think between Church and South Tryon on 4th Street, providing them no means of escape, and then discharged tear gas and pepper bullets on them. And it's now resulted in a series of multiple investigations being launched into that. Kerr Putney says that police on the scene will now change their approach. They will now let protesters know what their options are,
so that they can disperse without having to be exposed to any chemical munitions in the future. We want to make sure we're abundantly clear about the potential escape routes prior to deployment.
So that's just one of the procedural changes that CMPD will engage in. What are some of the others?
Well, I know one of them doesn't really have to do with that incident, but more so, police brutality issues. The chief also spoke about the calls from community activists to have a duty to intervene. As we've seen with the George Floyd issue, the other officers, as we see in the video, just stood there. But also going back to the Dan Chris Franklin shooting, and many said that the officers that were there didn't give him medical aid soon enough. And so now the chief said that they will, they have added to the policy that officers now have a duty to intervene. It was all that, and they put life, human life, is now added to this policy on duty to intervene. So I know that was one thing that came out from what the chief said, in addition to the what you played there.
And getting back to the use of chemical agents, tear gas, they can't buy more tear gas next year, but they have this stockpile, and they are not forbidden to use it. And one of the things that I believe the police will now do is only use it to disperse what they describe as unlawful crowds, to stop riotous behavior and to ensure safety. And that has to follow. The use of that tear gas has to follow each time a crowd reassembles. So if they disperse a crowd and they reassemble, they have to give out the same warnings and the same options for escape that they gave the first time before they use the tear gas. What constitutes an unlawful protest?
Well, unlawful crowd, Katie, go ahead.
I was just going to say, once they give a dispersal order to a crowd and the crowd doesn't disperse, that crowd or protest becomes unlawful, because they are supposed to basically kind of leave the area. And so the police have said that before the Tuesday night incident last week, they did issue a dispersal order. However, many of the protesters that we've talked to, I wasn't in that particular one, but many of the protesters we've talked to have said that they didn't hear anything before the police fired those chemical agents. So I think it's essentially just whenever the police tell you to leave.
Okay, we have to take a break. We'll come back with more on the protests and the result of the protests here and around the country in terms of changes being made, including our new mural on South Tryon Street. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup here, as we do every Friday morning and again on Saturday morning for those of you who listen to the rebroadcast. Steve Harrison joins us, our political reporter here at WFAE, along with Nick Oxner, investigative executive producer for WBTV, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News, anchor reporter there, and Katie Peralta, senior editor for the Charlotte Agenda. Another order of business on Monday night City Council meeting involved the council unanimously passing a resolution requesting that CMPD adopt an eight can't wait police reform initiative. What would that do? Katie.
So,
or Steve.
So that's from a national organization that's pushing police reform. It's eight proposals, and the resolution says that it wants for CMPD to try and align themselves with those eight. Some of them the police already do. Or in theory do. I'm not saying they do it, but it's part of their policy, like de-escalation. There's others that would have a complete ban on chokeholds. In CMPD, they're prohibited unless it's absolutely necessary. And I think what happened on Monday night was the eight can't wait was going to be kind of the fallback position to do something. Because as of Saturday, as of 2 days before the vote, Braxton Winston did not have six votes to pass the tear gas purchase ban. And I think it's interesting because this was really, and I've seen in his 3 years on council, kind of his first big win where he was able to marshal six votes to get something passed. The criticism of him has been that he kind of throws an idea out there and can't get the majority of council along. And this time he did it.
And that came, I believe, over the weekend prior to that vote, after other organizations in the state the Democratic Party passed a resolution banning tear gas. Gary McFadden passed a resolution, and I think that don't you think that helped a little bit get that resolution through the city council?
I do, and I think also on Monday night, I mean, even though council, they weren't at the government center, they're all remote by Zoom. I think the biggest crowd of all the protests had gathered that night, and so yeah, I think it really tipped about three votes in his favor.
So this eight can't wait resolution, which passed unanimously, bans chokeholds, requires de-escalation. Some of the things, as you said, the police already do. It requires a warning before shooting. It requires that police exhaust all alternatives before shooting. There is a duty to intervene, which is something that the governor has put into his proposals as well. And it bans shooting at moving vehicles, establishes use of force continuum, and requires that all use of force be reported. This was a motion by Larkin Eggleston, another city council member, but it is a resolution. CMPD is not required to adopt these things. Is that right?
Well, yeah. Except yes, but CMPD is largely already doing most of these things, mostly because they've had to revise their policies and procedures in response to years of other incidents before this, right? And so I don't think this is the sea change for CMPD that it might be in other departments across the country.
And the governor's gotten involved in police reform. On Tuesday, he signed an executive action on racial equity to help eliminate systemic racism in our criminal justice system. Those are his words. And he created a task force. What has he charged the task force with doing?
Task force has a pretty big agenda. I mean, it's tasked with everything from overseeing things like, environmental justice to access to affordable health care. On like a granular basis, how this will work and how this group will advise policy, I'm not entirely sure. I think that it was obviously a direct response to the protests ongoing. I haven't heard much reaction to it, to be completely honest, but clearly, the governor wants to do something. He wants to take some sort of action. And he, he's been supportive of the protesters. He's been out with them on the street. And so I think that this is clearly something that he's listening to and paying attention to.
And he wants that task force report filed by December the 1st. I'm not sure what happens then. Well, I guess we'll talk about it in December. North Carolina Public Safety Secretary Eric Hooks has directed all state law enforcement agencies to ensure that they have a clear duty to intervene policy which means if one officer is sees another officer doing something he thinks is wrong or over-aggressive, he would intervene. He or she would intervene. Has that directive gone into effect?
Not sure about that.
Okay.
You were asking about the duty to intervene?
Yes, from Public Safety Secretary Eric Hooks.
That I don't know. I just know the city of CMPD has, so.
And there have been news reports. There have been news reports of several CMPD officers who have volunteered to be out amongst the group, talking to protesters and listening to protesters. Mostly listening. That was the directive. But CMPD Captain Brad Koch?
Yes.
Has been regularly protesting. But in a recent protest, he evidently got into an argument with a protester, and they wrestled each other to the ground. And as everything is these days, it was caught on camera phone video, which has now gone viral. What happened there?
Pretty much just as you described it from the video. It's not clear the extent of how much the exchange between Koch and the protesters was an argument, or if it was the nature of the interaction beforehand, but the video is very clear that they were then rolling on the ground afterwards. Right. And most notably, I think, is the fact that another protester got in between the ones who were on the ground with Koch and the officer and broke it up.
And some of the crowd have now began to turn on the officer who's out there pretty much being peaceful and trying to set up some sort of a relationship. Has this been an isolated incident, or is the crowd not trusting police no matter what?
Well, it's worth noting the night before the incident at the government center, there was a second incident where a small group of protesters got in his face as well, Koch's face as well. Largely, though, I would say the group that was involved in the government center incident is a group that's separate from most of the organizations that have been protesting and marching. Feels like more of an isolated incident related specifically to Koch. CMPD is quick to point out that there are more than a dozen officers that have been injured. Some, they say, more seriously than just, you know, having rolled around on the ground. So there has been limited amounts of incidents involving police.
So on Tuesday, 17 Charlotte artists took a page from Washington, D.C. and painted the phrase Black Lives Matter on South Tryon Street. Aside from being inspired by what happened in Washington at the behest of the mayor there, was this an organic effort, or did the city encourage this in some way?
So it was kind of twofold. Answer to your question. It was the assistant city manager, who was also the chief city planner, Taiwo Jayoba. He, after he saw what happened in Washington, D.C., were told that he then reached out to the mayor, wanted to do something similar with Uptown Charlotte. So he reached out to her. We're told that the mayor gave it the go-ahead. So it'll be on Tryon for 2 weeks. And I think this is because the city is repaving streets through Uptown. And I don't believe they've done Tryon yet just because of the gold line. So he would know they have this little 2 week window when they can do something like this. And so that essentially it was organic, but also there were some city officials that were involved.
So
go ahead. I was gonna say, the city also provided the materials for the artists, and they provided a small stipend for each artist to complete these works. But they had partnered with a couple of nonprofit organizations that committed, you know, one artist to each letter of the mural. Pretty remarkable. They really completed it within the span of a day. It was 90 degrees outside, sweltering heat, but they were able to wrap it all up in a day.
And it's not just yellow paint as it is in D.C. As you say, they went out, once they laid down the foundation, went out and decorated each artist. Each letter is themed by the artist who did it. And it brought out a lot of people just to look at what was going on, to bear witness to it. Summer Dice came with her dog because she wanted to support the black artists who created the mural.
There's clearly a lot of emotion tied to art, and there's a lot of emotion tied to activism. So I think those things coming together isn't a huge stretch for me.
And Larry Kennedy also came out for a look and pointed out that both black and white artists worked together to make this piece come to life.
To come out and see this happen in Charlotte, Black Lives Matter movement, is huge. And it was a lot of effort put in on a lot of people, a lot of different races. So it shows we can be united in this country. Unity exists in this country. Good people exist in this country.
Not every American city has done this. I think there are about four or five who have allowed this to happen, who encouraged this to happen. What does it say about Charlotte that we are among that small group of cities?
It certainly, I think not only was this mural part of a forward thinking movement, but if you look at the way this one was put together with a real community effort with these artists, the atmosphere down there was one of celebration and very upbeat and light. And so this was a really nice and positive way to do something and for the city to get involved in doing something in response to the moment.
Things are changing a lot in a lot of different venues and areas. NASCAR took a major step in response to the protests around the country and the growing awareness of inequities. They banned the Confederate flag at all of its races and on all of its properties. This issue was pushed by NASCAR's lone black driver, Bubba Wallace.
Bravo. Props to NASCAR. And that was a huge pivotal moment for the sport. A lot of backlash, but it creates doors and allows the community to come together as one.
That happened before Wednesday night's race at Martinsville, where where Wallace drove. And he drove his Chevrolet with Black Lives Matter painted on it. What has been the reaction to both that and the fact that NASCAR has said no more Confederate flags? Because this did not happen 5 years ago, following the shooting of all those individuals at the Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston. Why now, and what has been the reaction to it?
Well, something that Bubba Watson, Bubba Wallace called for last week. He, wanted NASCAR to at long last address this. I mean, when you think about it, yes, it is a very big move for, this driving governing body that was born in the South. It has, the hardcore base tends to be older and conservative, but
white.
At the same time, NAS and white a lot of the time. Yeah. Bub is the lone black driver, as you said. I think that at the same time, NASCAR realized that they didn't really have much to lose here and they had a lot to gain. The reaction has therefore been largely positive, as much as I've heard. I've seen people chiming in with, oh, maybe I'll start watching NASCAR now. Maybe it's time to start paying attention. There have been a couple people who have, I think there was one NASCAR truck driver who said that he's leaving the sport because he doesn't agree with the decision. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think NASCAR realizes that it's time to get with the times. And this really is long overdue. I'm not sure why it didn't happen sooner.
And it can't be overstated that, NASCAR has had a long history of being associated with racism and as of course, images behind the Confederate flag. So it's history making that they would make such a bold decision when we, haven't seen that sort of bold statement from, for example, the president, who was a strong supporter of NASCAR.
Well, yeah, and the president is going, of course, to Tulsa to do a big speech next Friday, which happens to be Juneteenth, which is the anniversary of a massacre, I think the biggest massacre in American history, in which they used aerial bombing in the 1920s to literally wipe out an African-American area of Tulsa. And the timing could not be worse, and one wonders if they could not have been completely ignorant of the timing of that at the White House. An official statement from NASCAR said the presence of the Confederate flag at NASCAR events runs contrary to our commitment to providing a welcoming and inclusive environment for all fans, our competitors, and our industry. So it's laudable, but I wonder what they're going to do about all those tattoos. Can't bring a flag in, but what about those tattoos? This week also saw the removal of the statue of former Panthers owner Jerry Richardson from in front of the Bank of America Stadium, and the team has said this is in the interest of public safety. But in the paper this morning, I think it's Scott Fowler is writing that the statue will not be back. He has two sources saying that the statue will not be back. It was this removed because they were afraid that protesters would topple it or deface it or be hurt by toppling it? Or was it because of something else?
I think probably both. I mean, I think we all probably saw chatter on Twitter and that was people were talking about that might be kind of the next phase or a possibility with protests. So I think that's part of it. But I think also in terms of the new ownership group, the decision, it kind of follows a lot of the other moves they've made and the spirit they brought to the organization. So I think it's
absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, just if you use the example of kneeling, I mean, Jerry Richardson, we now know, told them not to. And David Tepper, on the other hand, has encouraged their protesting. So.
And this week, the Panthers, along with the Hornets and the Knights, and apparently a lot of other companies and individuals, have dropped CPI security over comments made by the company's CEO. He was responding to a mass email sent to various businesses by Queen City Unity about the Black Lives Matter movement. What did he say that caused such a stink?
He go ahead, Jonathan.
No. Ladies first. Go ahead.
I was going to say he essentially told Jorge Molares, who's the head of that group, that protesters ought to, you know, redirect their focus on other matters, essentially, really kind of diminish the efforts of protesters. And, you know, he addressed Jorge as George. I think that's another thing that gets overlooked. And I think that it really, you know, it was racist. I don't know if everyone's using that term, but that's
the quote is, a better use of time would be to focus on the black on black crime and senseless killing of our young men by other young men, was the direct quote from Mr. Gill.
And evidently, a lot of people are scrambling to cancel their service with CPI because the call time, the wait time on hold is 24 hours, which I've never heard happen ever on anything. A lot of things happened this week here and around the country because of the protests over the death of George Floyd. It's even put new pressure on removing Confederate statues everywhere from the Capitol in Washington, D.C. to the capital of the Confederacy in Richmond, Virginia, where they did take down a statue of Jefferson Davis. And the call to rename all of these military bases that have the names of Confederate generals on them. Is this a moment in our history where we have closed a chapter? Only have 20 seconds.
Closing, maybe? I don't know that we've closed it yet, but we've picked up the page off the next one.
Okay. We'll come back with more because the Republican National Convention is moving the big night to Jacksonville. But we know that for a fact now. It was back and forth and back and forth. Well, now it's done. And we'll talk about the implications of that and more when we come back on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, 90.3 WFHE. It's the local news roundup. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Steve Harrison, our political reporter here at WFAE. Katie Peralta is the senior editor with Charlotte Agenda. Jonathan Lowe, anchor reporter for Spectrum News. And Nick Oxner, investigative executive producer for WBTV. We were talking about all the things that have changed and have been called for change. And one of the things that's been called for is the changing of the names of all these military bases that bear the names of Confederate generals. And the reason they bear the names of Confederate generals is that most of them came about just prior to World War I. You're about 50 years away, and most of them are in the South. And you're about 50 years away at that time from the end of the Civil War. And to get these facilities built quickly, you had to capture the support of Southern politicians at the time who were still identifying with the Confederate war effort, and that's why they bear those names. For weeks now, we've been playing this game of cat and mouse between the president and Roy Cooper about whether or not we could have a full-fledged, unmasked, unsocially distanced convention at the Spectrum Center in August for the Republican National Convention. We're not going to hear from Ronna McDaniel, who's the head of the Republican National Committee, because the cut that we had talked about Jacksonville being in the front, being the front runner. It has now been decided, Steve. Jacksonville is where the big night will be, correct?
That's right. Yeah. And I think the big the big reason that Jacksonville is the winner is that so you had several Republican governors who said they wanted the convention, but Jacksonville has a Republican mayor, Republican city council. That really kind of paved the way for this, because so many of these other cities have Democratic mayors just because of that's how our politics are today, and they weren't interested. So the GOP kind of finally found a sweet spot where they had a city big enough with a local political base willing to take them in.
Their arena there is slightly smaller than ours. I think it's 15,000 as opposed to 18,000, but it's going to be a quick event, unlike a 3 or 4 day convention. They're still holding part of it here. And I'm wondering why, because they're now saying that 336 people will come here for 1 day to do what?
So they will come, and it will be 6 delegates for each state and territory, and they will come and officially nominate the president and vice president for a second term. And right, you say, why are they going to come at all? Because it's all going to be in probably one hotel. Why do this at all? And I think the reason is they have contracts with the city and the local host committee to have some form of a convention here. I know the contract with the city doesn't really say what that is. I mean, it doesn't say how many people, how many hotel rooms. So they are kind of checking the box, and they're going to show up and do the least amount possible. And I mean, in the fairness to the Republican National Committee, right now in North Carolina, you can't have gatherings of more than 10 people inside. So there's really not much they could do. So they're going to play within the rules, show
up. How are they going to do that? How are they going to do 336 people in the same room at the same time?
I don't know specifically, but I think you could have each state meet together, vote by Zoom. I mean, you might not even have to go into a hotel ballroom. I mean, they just might say, like, all right, Wyoming, let's go to your hotel room. And they all may crowd in and say yes. And then they're going to head back to the airport. So
they're here because of contractual obligations. And I spoke to Mayor Lyles on Wednesday about this, who said that we were at the time, before this was decided last night, that we are ready to stand by our obligation to host this convention. And I asked her if the GOP pulls the plug, if we get back any of the money that we have already been spending.
This is a contract obligation, and we have looked at it just as that. So today, if they said, well, we went to Jacksonville and we couldn't make it work, and we're going to make it work and prescribe to the requirements for the COVID-19, we would host this convention because we have that obligation. But we're in a pandemic. They have to make that decision on their own. And whatever decision they make, that's when we start talking about how the contract works. And I can't speak to that right now.
So I guess they're talking about how the contract works right now. But she did say that money we've received for security, and I think that's around $50 million, could be used to cover some of the other expenses should they decide not to come.
We accepted a $50 million security grant, and there are expenses that we've made, and we have would expect that grant would cover those expenses because we have dealt with this in good faith.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Go ahead. Sorry, Mike. I was just going to say what's interesting about that is that the city attorney just said about a week ago that they have spent $14 million of that $50 million that they expect to get reimbursed for. So it would be interesting to see how that plays out. You know, are they going to get reimbursed now that the convention has been scaled back here? But I do remember the city attorney saying they've spent so far $14 million.
And the mayor's right. I mean, the city is legally, there's a contract. They're supposed to get reimbursed. But the money is coming from the Department of Justice. That's, of course, part of the Trump administration. So, I mean, I would not be surprised. The city, I think, will get its money eventually. But that may be in 2021 or 2025 when there's a new president. I don't think that they're going to be in any hurry to send Charlotte $14 million.
So this back and forth, we just became aware of it a couple of weeks ago. But the New York Times reports the president started having misgivings about holding the convention here back in January. Do we know if those misgivings were tied to politics or to COVID-19 and his worries about that? Do we know?
I mean, it couldn't have been COVID-19 because, you know, I mean, I don't think really anyone in January thought this was going to be the problem it is. That is some reporting that I have no idea about those internal conversations in the White House. But I wouldn't be surprised if that was also kind of people in the White House laying the groundwork saying, oh, well, we were done with North Carolina anyway. It didn't matter. We were going to win it. There's no reason to hold a convention here.
Yeah, but this is what we have, a contract. And this is not the first promise or change of heart, that the first promise broken or change of heart on the part of Donald Trump. And I asked the mayor if she has any regrets about signing a contract with a party headed by someone who is known for breaking contracts.
I have no regrets about going after something that the city would have benefited from in the way that we planned at the beginning. I mean, it would have been amazing to have this opportunity to be on international media. It would have been a great opportunity to fill every hotel room. It would have been difficult perhaps because of the president's presence for us for a number of reasons. But 2 years ago, I feel like we were doing the right thing.
So, Katie, how is the hospitality industry, which was set to make a boatload of money on this convention with 50,000 people coming in here originally? That was the prediction. How are they handling this? What has been the reaction? Aside from disappointment.
The ones I spoke with this week actually didn't really have any idea that there was going to be a very scaled down event here. They had been told nothing differently by RNC officials to, you know, expect only a few people instead of, you know, 50,000. So they kind of were still banking on some sort of boost from the RNC. By a few estimates, this thing was supposed to have a total economic impact of up to, you know, $160 million. So, you know, at a time when they were already pretty, you know, pretty devastated by revenue lost from coronavirus, yeah, they were looking forward to this as the proverbial shot in the arm.
Can hotels collect fees for cancellations from various delegations?
That's a really good question. And it's something that I need to get a bit more clarity on. You know, a couple of hotels like in the direct vicinity to the Spectrum Center, you know, the Ritz-Carlton has like 140 some rooms. You know, the Westin's a little bit farther away, but I think that some hotels still will see a little bit of a bump, because there will still be a few hundred people here. Reason does stand to tell us that there would be some sort of contractual, you know, money that they would still be reimbursed. And not only that, but just that thousands of members of the media who were supposed to have booked hotel rooms by now, you know, and guests, you know, convention guests, I'm not sure, you know, what those cancellations look like in total. But the other thing I thought was really interesting this week, you know, a really sad, unfortunate reality of, you know, writing about the hospitality industry during a pandemic and a recession is that a lot of these people have been laid off. So it was really hard to get answers about this, especially from Marriott, which has laid off over 700 people in the Charlotte area. So, you know, this is another blow for an industry that's already kind of, you know, reeling here.
And in fact,
Mike, I was going to say one thing. Just, I got an email just now from the host committee. You know, they're the headed by former city council member John Lasseter, which has to raise the $70 million. They just sent out an email that said, quote, "We need to stop pretending there's any part of the convention that will remain in Charlotte." You know, so even this idea of 300 delegates coming here, I mean, I think they're still going to come, but they're saying that doesn't count. That's just a farce. Kind of interesting.
And certainly no media will come here to cover 326 people, it would seem. All of this is due, obviously, to COVID-19. We have no way of knowing what the situation will be like here in August, which is the problem that we run into without being able to promise the president what he wants. And right now, what we're seeing is not good. It looks like August may be really not good here. Hospitalizations in the state have reached a record 812, the most since the outbreak started. The number of cases continues to swiftly rise. Here we are, one of the hot spots in the country. And the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services reported on Thursday an additional 1,310 cases, the number of new cases on Thursday being the second highest ever reported in the state. Our health secretary here, Mandy Cohen, was on yesterday's morning edition on NPR, and she told Rachel Martin that the state took aggressive action, which helped, but not enough.
What we have seen, particularly in the last 2 weeks since our second phase of reopening, is that our numbers are really, as you said, going in the wrong direction. In the last week, we've had 4 days of more than 1,000 new cases in each one of those days. And importantly, we are seeing our hospitalizations go up, so more people having serious illness. This is an early warning sign for us that we don't forget that COVID-19 is with us. I know folks are weary at this point, but we really need to stay vigilant.
And Rachel Martin pointed out that the number of cases isn't just going up here. It's going up in places like Arizona and Oregon and, wait for it, Florida. So why is Florida willing to risk this when we are not?
Well, the difference, Mike, is North Carolina never really saw a decline. If you look at extrapolated North Carolina's case count versus states, other states across the country, some states like Florida, Texas, and what have you, Arizona, are seeing a new resurgence, a spike. North Carolina's kind of leveled off a little bit, but it's been climbing the entire time. Yeah. Florida says that it has the has said over the last weeks that it has the capability to quickly respond and contain outbreaks in its state. And that, you know, something North Carolina has not had the ability to do.
I wonder why. Cohen also pointed out that she and the governor have been following the number of cases very carefully, and things looked stable at the time, and that is why they moved to the phase two of reopening.
But as we start to reopen, we do see these trends moving in the wrong direction. And the governor and I have said that we will use all of our tools. And if we need to go back to stay at home, we will. I hope we don't have to. I think there are things we can do before we have to get there. But, yes, we are concerned. And we're going to make sure we're taking action.
Mandy Cohen, who is the state's health director, had a conversation by phone with Deborah Birx this week, Nick. She is on the president's COVID-19 task force. What did they talk about?
Yeah, and that conversation was last Friday. We know about it because Roy Cooper mentioned it kind of offhandedly at his press conference this past Monday. And what we know we talked about is Deborah Birx, the chair of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, expressed concern about North Carolina's handling of COVID-19. This predates, according to an official on the task force that I spoke with this week, predates the reopening of North Carolina. And that concern really, the task force official tells me, is centered on North Carolina's inability to move testing around to hotspots. And they're particularly concerned about North Carolina's lack of testing in nursing homes, in prisons, and in agriculture facilities and meatpacking facilities, three areas where we know the virus can easily spread. And so the White House and a Republican U.S. congressman from Eastern North Carolina, who talked with Dr. Birx about her conversation this week, both pushed back on this notion that Governor Cooper and Secretary Cohen have put out there that, oh, the numbers are spiking now. The White House task force says, no, if you look at the numbers, North Carolina has been on an upward trajectory, and they owe a lot of that in part to North Carolina's lack of testing in these settings where you know you have a lot of outbreaks.
And why, if we have a weakness, why do we have the weakness? Because it seems to me that the Governor Cooper and Mandy Cohen have been vigilant on this, or apparently they have given the impression of being vigilant.
Well, they say they've been vigilant. However, if they were vigilant, if you listen to what the White House says, is that North Carolina hasn't moved testing. And that's what they say other states have been able to do. So when you see a spike in one spot in your state, then you surge the testing so you can identify the positives, and then you do your contact tracing to isolate those cases. Well, we are not doing that in North Carolina. We were slow to do testing in our nursing homes. We still don't have mandatory testing in our nursing homes. We've been slow and almost reluctant to test in our prisons. We're just now, last week, a judge ordered the Department of Public Safety to come up with a plan to test all inmates. We're still not testing all staff in prisons. We have secrecy surrounding our cases in meatpacking plants where DHHS won't give information, specific details about the number of outbreaks in meatpacking plants. We know that the cases spread easily there because of the climate and the nature of the work. And so North Carolina has taken lots of steps to do the opposite of be vigilant in these places where we know the outbreaks continue to rise and are more, and the populations are more susceptible.
And coincidentally, this is all happening as Judge Vincent Rozier of Wake County Superior Court has ruled that conditions inside our state's prisons are likely unconstitutional due to the state's failure to provide substantial testing for COVID-19 to people in the prisons and for failure to follow public health guidelines for limiting the spread of the disease there. We are out of time. I want to thank Nick Oxter from WBTV, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News, Katie Peralta from Charlotte Agenda, and Steve Harrison from WFAE News for the hour. Thanks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.